When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Supernatural Circumstances, the podcast where we take you down the rabbit hole into the fantastic world of the strange, the paranormal, and the unknown. I'm Morgan Knutson.
And I am Mike Brown. It's time to dim the lights and settle in. Come along with us on this week's adventure. Wow. So we're going to be talking to Alex Matsuo today.
Yeah, and she is such a wealth of knowledge about women in the paranormal, which is kind of our month.
Yeah.
You know, which is kind of our month, which is so cool. And this case in particular, I thought was so relevant because very recently we've had the release of the movie The Exorcist, the new Exorcist film.
Which I hated.
I have not seen it.
Oh, God. Well, let's just say it is not The Exorcist.
Oh, well, nothing's going to be The Exorcist, though.
The director needs to be stopped, what I'm going to say. But anyway.
Yeah. But the original was amazing. And that's what we're talking about today, is the original. And not just the true story behind The Exorcist film, but the location, which...
That's fascinating to me, because I used to work in locations for film. So I always like a story where there's a location that has a history behind it, especially when it comes to a movie like The Exorcist and what we're going to talk about today, because that is like, what? Are you kidding? This is so weird.
Like, and so many people have visited The Exorcist steps, the famous steps where Father Karras tumbled down at the end and lost his life. And, the place that used to be there, which was Prospect Cottage, has this incredible story about this amazing woman by the name of Eden Southworth. And we're going to get into her story and the haunting that was there, maybe still is there. This is so cool. And yet, again, another woman who has gone by the wayside, you know, that we've not heard of.
Right. It's interesting how many of these stories there are out there that aren't being told, and especially this one, because this is one of those stories that, had I known about it before, I would have talked to other people about it a lot, because it's so fascinating, because I love the movie The Exorcist, and not Exorcist Believer. Not.
Yeah, I mean, it was such an iconic film, and I mean, maybe that's why her story maybe got washed under the bridge a little bit as well, is the fact that, you know, that this haunting is so vastly different than The Exorcist.
Well, there's that, and there's also a lot of noise already about that particular movie. So
yeah,
let's bring it to the forefront if we can.
Oh, let's do it, because I can't wait to get into this. Alex is the expert, so let's talk to her.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Okay, well, let's kick into this, because I'm excited. I'm so excited to have you, first of all, Alex. It's so great.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate that.
It has been, like, something I've been meaning to do for like since we started this show. I'm like, why has this not happened?
Nice.
I've got to get you on here. You're such an authority on a lot of this stuff and so many different stories. And congratulations on your book.
Thank you.
Yeah, she wrote a book, Women of the Paranormal. And it's super cool.
Women of the Paranormal, Volume 1. So there's more.
I started the project app with 12 names, just 12.
Sure.
And then it exploded into over 100 names now. So there's definitely going to be a Volume 2, if not a Volume 3. So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
It's nice when you sort of find yourself in a rabbit hole that gives you lots to write about, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's definitely nice, and I appreciate the help of all the librarians that I've leveraged in the past year and a half. They kind of were the reason why this exploded into multiple things.
It's like, oh cool, I have a name for you.
Exactly. And then I would look at like co-authors of papers, and then I'm mm-hmm. like, oh, that looks like an interesting name, let me look that up. Oh, okay, there's another woman. Oh snap, she did X, Y, and Z. So yeah, it's how have I not heard of this person before? So yeah.
It's so cool. And I mean, I think what you're doing is so important. We just had on Allison Jornlin recently.
Oh nice.
We were talking about Catherine Crowe and that the saga of Catherine Crowe, and I was going through your work and stuff like that and looking at, you know, who we could talk about. And of course, first thing that comes up is the original story of course, The Exorcist, which mm-hmm. most people have seen the movie. But then there's the ones who are too frightened to do it. But most people, I think, in our demographic have seen the movie. And you wrote a phenomenal piece about the house, what is known as the Exorcist House, which is basically a massive tourist attraction, even though the house is privately owned.
Yep.
It's got this incredible story. And this isn't the house, for the audience, this isn't the house that the original exorcism was in. This is the house that was, that the movie that we see on the poster that were, you know, that had the stairs that Father Karras tumbled down. This is the house we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
It's so cool. How did this start for you?
I always had an interest in The Exorcist overall. It was one of the first horror movies I had ever watched. It was a really bad werewolf film called Bad Moon. But The Exorcist was like the more memorable one because, yeah, that scared the bejesus out of me. So I moved to the D.C. area in January of 2022. And someone had sent me a message just to remind me, hey, you know The Exorcist was filmed in Georgetown, right? And I'm like, that's true. I live 5 minutes away from Georgetown. What the heck? So yeah, actually, literally before I went to any of like the Capitol sites, the White House, Lincoln Memorial, Vietnam War Memorial, you know, the National Mall, I went to the Exorcist steps.
Oh, wow. Absolutely.
Like, I had to. And one, they're just as intimidating in person as they are on screen. They are a beast to walk up.
I bet.
And yeah. They are terrifying to walk down.
Like, so it's actually that steep that it's hard to navigate.
Absolutely. So, and here's the thing, like, so it was really hard for me to get pictures initially because we have these superhero rock stars who are working out. They use the stairs as a workout space. So they just go up and down the stairs. That's all they do. And I'm like, well, that's goals if I didn't like donuts so much. So it's just a steep, and walking up was a trek. But yeah, I think it was actually worse to walk down them because the angle that they're in when you're going down is really, it's steep. It's alarming. Like literally there were times like I was actually holding the rail with both hands, and I'm like, I am like one toe misplacement away from just tumbling down this and pulling a Father Karras.
I was just going to say, recreating the scene a little bit too closely, hey?
Yeah. Oh, no.
And the other thing was, I know that they coated the steps with, like, I think it was like an inch or two of rubber on each step. So, because I know he did his own stunt with that. But I'm sitting here, I'm like, I don't know how the heck he did this. Because they're steep and it hurts, I'm sure, even with the rubber. And it was quite the experience. And then, of course, I had to walk up all the way up the stairs. And then, lo and behold, there's the house right there. And it's just chilling. It's just right there, you know. And the gate is open. You can walk right by it. You could take your picture in front of it. I have not seen the owners yet, and I've been there quite a few times, but I've heard that the owners are actually pretty cool, like they'll even help take pictures, but I don't go near the house, at least I don't cross the sidewalk, and I don't really take pictures unless I'm on the other side of the intersection, because I don't want to be that person, you know?
I'm looking at a picture of you on your website laying face down below the stairs.
You're a girl after my own heart. I would be doing the exact same thing.
Oh my gosh.
It's so cool.
There were so many creators at the steps. Every time I go, there's always a creator there. And they're always like, nothing against them, but they're always posing like on the railing and looking really adorable and cute and looking fabulous. And I was just like, you know what? I'm going to do something different.
Oh, you did it right. You absolutely did it right. So this was once the location of a little cottage called Prospect Cottage, right? Who was this owned by?
Prospect Cottage, quite the mystery surrounding it. So
yeah, I love this story. Like, this has got me having so many questions. I'm excited. So
yeah, and I kind of fell into the story by accident. So I'm not sure. I haven't been able to find who built it, and it's not even known like when this was built either. All I got from a newspaper article, I'm trying to remember, it was a Washington Post. It was the Record Union out of Sacramento. You know, I have my notes right here. but we do know that it may have been owned by a French minister, a former French minister. Not sure exactly when it was built. But then after that, at some point, this really amazing woman that I wish I knew more about, her name was Eden Southworth, and she was possibly one of the most successful, highest paid authors of her day.
Cool.
Which is really kind of unheard of. I mean, her origin story is amazing. So she ended up moving into Prospect Cottage, and it seems for a time she did not leave even after death.
Oh, dear.
This is so interesting, Mike. Like, first of all, this lady, like you were saying, Alex, she wrote over 60 novels in her career, and it was all women and heroines who were really trying to break out of the box, which I think is so, so significant for this story. Mm-hmm. because she really did. And she was a really big supporter of everything from women's rights to, you know, all of those different things. And to me, her story is really interesting, and it's fitting to me how this kind of plays out after a little while.
Yep. And she was a contemporary and a friend of Harriet Beecher Stowe too.
Mm-hmm.
That's fascinating. So Eden, she ended up getting married at like 21, but she was a school teacher. It was like by the age of 16.
Yeah. So her mother died when she was fairly young. And then her father remarried, and she was not a big fan of her stepmother. Or no, it was her father that passed. Her mother married a teacher. His name is Joshua Henshaw, and got that reversed. But yeah, so Eden was not a big fan of her stepfather, but it seemed that she kind of expedited her education so that she could be independent a little quicker. So by the time she was 15, she was already done with her education. And then she started teaching at 16.
Jeez. Like, just so many of the women of that time period. And like, as Mike and I have noticed this as we've been delving into this side of it. There's so many really smart, smart mm-hmm. women, and so many of them get into the literature side of things. Like, and their works, it's not like they're unknown works. Their works are profound and they've been extremely popular. Like, it's so strange to me that a lot of these names just go missing.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so she was a teacher at 16. She actually got married at 21. So at that time in 1840, that was a bit later in life.
Oh, you're an old maid by 21.
Yeah. Right. And she married an inventor. His name was Frederick Southworth. He was from New York. Then the couple moved to Wisconsin. So you go from, you know, Georgetown and New York to Wisconsin. So they were living on the frontier. And Eden was not a fan. She was like, nope, this isn't what I signed up for.
Fair enough.
She ended up having two children with Frederick. And then Frederick actually abandoned her and the kids to search for gold in South America.
Oh, Frederick.
You know, got to go find those big dreams, you know, in South America. And so she actually went back to D.C., Washington, D.C. In 1844 without him. So, you know, that probably stirred up some gossip there too. But she went back to teaching. So she went back to what she knew. And she was earning about $250 per year as a teacher. So, and this was 1844. So, you know, inflation is a thing. But yeah, so, but still not making enough to, you know, support two young children and being a single mother. So, Yeah. So she started writing to supplement her income. She submitted stories to magazines. She caught the attention of the editor, of the National Era. And they really wanted to give her a contract for a novel. And then, as Morgan said, this kind of escalated into 60 novels, you know, in her career. And she was making an annual salary of $10,000. So she was able to quit teaching. She was able to quit teaching and write full time.
Just amazing, amazing women we stand on the shoulders of. It's really cool. So around 1853, 1860s, somewhere in there, she ends up moving into Prospect Cottage,
mm-hmm.
where The Exorcist steps and the house is now.
Yep.
And it's like you were saying, they're not too sure when it was built. And whatnot. But so what was her life like in Prospect Cottage? Because this was like basically, as you described it, a little gingerbread house, essentially.
You know, for the time, it was quite a nice establishment. It was a beautiful house. And yeah, it really did. I mean, if you look up the pictures, I mean, there's so many historic photos mm-hmm. of Prospect Cottage. And I'll go into a little bit later why that's kind of ironic. But yeah, there's so many pictures, and she lived. So for those of you who have not ever been to Georgetown or not familiar with the landscape of it, so Virginia, you know, Virginia is on the other side of the Potomac River, and there is a bridge there. Basically, at the end of that bridge is the Exorcist Steps. So you can, and the Exorcist House. So you can stand at the top of the Exorcist Steps and look across the river to Virginia. So what Eden's life was like, well, there was a big thing that happened in the 1860s that you may have heard of, the Civil War.
Oh, there's that.
Yeah, there's that. So she was literally living at the gate of the North, like literally right there. Like, on the other side of the bridge, you know, where Virginia is, about half a mile away is Arlington National Cemetery. And Arlington National Cemetery used to be the home of Robert E. Lee. So she was right there. So sadly, it doesn't seem that she was really able to enjoy her home in the early parts of it. Because, you know, even around the 1850s, there was already tension building about, you know, the issues of slavery and North versus South. And this was already brewing, so to speak. So Eden actually ended up living in the house for majority of the Civil War. And she was, she was a very active supporter of the Union. So, yeah, but she could literally see the Confederacy from her house. Like, it's right there.
Wow.
Talk about being a part of history, hey?
Well, yeah, right. So when major battles were happening, especially, I think the one that really was, that ended up being concerning was the Battle of Antietam, which, was it Antietam? It was one of the major battles. Actually, no, it was a Virginia-based battle. I think it was the one that took place around Fredericksburg. But basically, the Confederacy won this particular battle. Wish I could remember the name of it. If Michelle Hamilton is listening, I'm sorry, my historian friend. So essentially what happened was the D.C., the North, was becoming very concerned that, okay, it was Bull Run. So Bull Run, which is in Manassas, it's about 40 minutes away from me driving. So we're talking like a day's worth of travel on foot, probably. So when the Confederates won that battle, they were on their way to D.C. This was a common thing that would happen, especially during those times when the Confederacy was doing pretty well during the Civil War. And again, Eden is right there. She's right there. If the Confederates were going to cross from Virginia into D.C., they would be going right by her house.
Holy. And she had... And this is to me where things kind of start for her and where things become a little bit on the supernatural side. She had an incident, and it was during the Battle of Bull Run, where she was barricaded in her house and something really interesting happened.
Yes.
Yeah. So talk about this, because this really gave me goosebumps.
So this one gave me goosebumps as well. So, you know, after the second Battle of Bull Run, Confederates were on their way. Very scary. Eden knew that her house would be probably stop number one and would probably be taken over by the Confederates, either as a hospital or as a meeting place.
Mm-hmm.
She knew that this was coming. And then she stood by the door, and, you know, she still had her, you know, her kids, they were a bit older at this point, but she stood by the door and she said, "There's only three of us here. What are we going to do if the Confederates come?" And this voice in the darkness responded and said, "There are four of you here, and you will be fine."
Oh, dear.
Oh, amazing. Like, just gives me chills.
Yeah, and it turns out Eden, her children, and their house was fine. I mean, that the voice was telling the truth.
As soon as I read that from your page, what it reminded me of was that connection with non-physical and just how important it is. You know, if that's what that was, you know, and it's...
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing, but it's definitely not the end of her story either. And she ends up selling the house eventually, right? She's like, okay, I'm done. And she ends up selling it.
She actually ended up passing away in the house.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. So what's really interesting was, so the exorcist steps were actually being constructed while she was alive.
Oh.
So
geez.
That's how old these steps are. So they were actually built for a place called Union Station. Today it's known as the Car Barn. But Georgetown had a streetcar system, and Union Station was where that was a stop, and that was also where the streetcars were being constructed. Again, maybe 50, 100 feet away from where Prospect Cottage was. So she passed away in 1899, and she was buried in Oak Hill Cemetery, so just up the hill from that area. Her son inherited the house, and he lived there until he passed away a year later, which is a little odd. But and then her daughter, Charlotte, inherited the house, but she wasn't interested in keeping it, so she ended up selling it. The house changed hands a few more times, and then Prospect Cottage then became an ice cream parlor.
I'm looking at the storefront here in the photo on your site, and it's really cool looking place now.
You know, right, right?
The Coca-Cola sign and get your ice cream here.
Yep, yep. And if you're looking at the photo where the fence is on the far left, that's basically where the steps are. And it's really literally on a hill. So if you were to stand on the patio in the far left, I mean, you would see the river and you would see everything. So it became an ice cream parlor with a sitting room. There was a drawing room. They sold live bait because, you know, the river's right there. Cigars, right. Tobacco, lunches, ice cream. You know, again, there was a streetcar stop right there. So there was a very popular spot for people to sit and wait for the streetcars. It pretty much kind of became a tourist trap because at this point, too, Eden did have quite the legacy. So it was like, oh, this is Eden Southward's house. So people would take, like, catch bugs and tell people it was from her house. They would rip off the wood as souvenirs. Oh, yeah. It was a hot mess. It was a hot mess.
Wow.
Oh, my. Well, nothing's changed, it seems.
No. I mean, the fact they were catching bugs, and I think they were also taking the plants, too. So it was one of those, Yeah. Fun times.
But Eden is still reported to be visiting Prospect Cottage. And this is the coolest thing to me because, you know, when we think about the case of The Exorcist and the original actual case and the movie, you've got this terrifying, you know, people throwing up in theaters, haunting. And that's not what's here. Here in this particular place, we've got a really positive, joyful haunting.
Yep.
Which is, I think, so surprising when... I think for a lot of people in our audience that are probably thinking right now, okay, when is this going to turn terrible? Well, it just turns amazing to me.
Mm-hmm.
What's been going on with Eden and this home?
There was a story in the Washington Post from 1905. So we're talking about 6 years after she had passed away. And this reporter must have caught wind about some of the local stories because, you know, people talk. But there was, he actually interviewed people about, you know, Eden Southworth being spotted at the house. And when she was spotted, she was very joyful, very happy to see people. And it's like, oh, come sit down in the parlor, you know, very like, you know, very welcoming. And it became a thing. So this article that was posted in the Washington Post, it just does tell the story. And I thought this was funny. I guess one of the first instances that happened was there was an Italian grocer who had his cart, you know, he had his little cart with, like, you know, different things to eat and everything. And this was probably I'm thinking this is before the parlor, the ice cream parlor was established.
Right.
So he's got his cart. He's sitting up in front of Prospect Cottage and he's getting ready for the day. And then he sees Eden coming out and saying hello to him. And but at this point, he knew that she had been dead for a couple years now. So... he didn't even wait to see what she was going to say to him. He ran and he left his cart in front of the house.
Oh, poor guy.
He was just like, nope. He noped right out of there.
it's so interesting to me, like how interactive she is with people that seem to be coming around there. I think that is so cool. Like it's not just a simple, you know, well, people have seen her apparition or something like that. It's like, no, she is legitimately interacting with people that are coming to the house. I think that's amazing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, she was coming in and talking to people, inviting them inside. And she was even seen by people like standing outside of the house. She was seen like in the window at night, looking out onto the streets. A lot of reports of her walking around the edges of the veranda and wringing her hands. She was very much still an active participant. And from what I read in these newspaper articles, it's not like she was like a see-through apparition or a wispy ghost. It seemed that she was just as real as, you know, you and I, you know, sitting in the same room together. It became quite a thing. I mean, and it was enough for people to talk about it and catch the attention of the Washington Post of all publications.
This is, I think, the type of story that needs to be told a lot more. Mike, you and I, we've talked about this so many times where so many of the nasty, horrible, terrifying things get picked out of the stories in the media. And you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's like if it doesn't scare the pants off you, somehow the media doesn't want to, you know, tell the story again. But I find some of these more interactive, playful ghost stories way more interesting. I don't need to be scared. I'm more interested in, oh, well, that's kind of cool.
Right. It's like, oh, I could go meet Eden Southworth, even though she passed away in 1899, you know?
Exactly. You mentioned the hand wringing, and I'm wondering if that could be residual energy left over from the time when she was awaiting the Confederates, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's just fascinating.
It was just such an interesting story to run into. And literally, it just kind of came from a curiosity of, okay, this house was built, you know, in the 1950s, the Exorcist house as we know it. But I'm like, what was here before? Because this is an amazing view. You know, yeah. I'm like, this is a great view. And it would make sense, given where it is, if there was a house here. So I just did some digging. And then I ran into, you know, these, because I just looked up the address and the intersections, because, you know, times change. I ran into this really delightful story. And I'm like, well, this is cool. Because, you know, that house isn't, as far as we know, isn't reported to be haunted, but it does have a stigma, you know, attached to it with, you know, the Exorcist.
Sure.
But there's an actual story here that exists, and a lot of people don't know about it.
And it makes you wonder too, like with the filming of the movie and things like that, because there was so many strange things that happened on set and things that happened around. It makes you wonder, like, was there a bit of a connection there as well? You know, some of the odd things that were going on.
This is where I find it ironic that this house was so well documented, but Georgetown in the 40s, man, I need to have a word with their town council, their board of directors, because basically this house ended up getting torn down in the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And I was not happy to read that. I mean, I knew the house wasn't there anymore, but just to find out that it was, you know, it was torn down because basically they didn't know really what to do with it. A woman's historical society did try to save it and use it. But there really wasn't much hope for it, unfortunately. The Francis Scott Key house, literally just down the steps from, you know, Eden's house, also suffered a similar fate. The town of Georgetown thought that it was an eyesore.
Oh, boy.
So they tore down the Francis Scott Key house in 1947.
Oh, geez.
Oh, yeah. And then they had stored the lumber and the bricks in hopes, in anticipation of reconstructing it and maybe putting it someplace else. But somehow those building supplies got lost.
Oh, boy.
They don't know what happened to them. So I have a couple issues with the Georgetown town council a little bit. But after the house got torn down, it seems that Eden disappeared as well. Maybe she decided to move on. I mean, that would make sense. I mean, if her house wasn't there anymore, she'd be like, all right, bye. From reading the stories about her, she doesn't come across as like a malevolent spirit or a vengeful spirit.
Not at all.
So it's almost like once her house was torn down, she was like, okay, bye.
And it really speaks to the legitimacy, I think, of the phenomenon as well. The fact that, you know, once that house was gone, you know, there wasn't a bunch of people that had moved into the house and said, oh, you know, we've seen her, we've seen this, we've seen that, you know, and nobody tried to capitalize on this, which to me really lends legitimacy of the original encounters.
But you bring up an interesting point, you know, all the weird things that may have happened around the filming. Was this Eden like having some fun and, mm-hmm. you know, do a little bit of missing?
Yeah, like I can't help but think that, she was probably aware that, you know, this was being used, this site was being used for the movie. And just that her playful nature and her wanting to interact kind of makes me wonder, you know, how much she was plugged into what was going on when they were doing the filming in a positive way, not a negative way.
She seemed to be a very positive and delightful presence. How nice would it be to get some ice cream and sit down and have a chat with a ghost, you know?
That would be awesome.
Phenomenal. And, you know, and people are so, when they think of ghosts, I think in the West especially, people are so conditioned to be so terrified of these things. And and then you go overseas and most of the time that's not the case at all. They've got a completely different outlook on spirits and being connected to loved ones and so on and so forth. And I wish we had that back. And
yep.
This story is such a testament to what it could be if we could just let go of the fear side of this and actually engage this in a way that was productive. And because I'm really a big believer in the fact that these intelligences, these entities, it's there for us to access if we allow it.
You know, I studied abroad in England for a year, very long time ago, and I had a ghost in my dorm. And when I talked to the porter about it, he was like, "Oh yeah, that's Joshua." And I'm like,
"Of course it is."
Okay. Oh. He's like, "Yeah, he won't hurt you. Just, you know, just when you come in late, just let him know, just apologize and go to bed." I'm like, "Okay." Or even like, you know, when you're buying a house over there, because I have a couple friends who live abroad now, you know, they were told like, "Oh yeah, this comes with the spirit of an old woman. You know, she really enjoys chamomile tea in the evening. So if you want to brew her a cup, you know, she'll be quiet in the evening at night." And I'm like, "Okay,
that's
cool,
great,
great."
I love it. I just love it. Like, I remember back in when I used to live on the south side of Edmonton, and my family and I, we had a continuous haunting. We don't know who it was, but it was in this apartment that we were living in. And I remember one specific incident that was so neat. My mom had been outside trying to hang up a birdhouse. We had this huge tree outside our front patio, and she was trying to get the nail in, and she realized, "Oh, I need a stepladder. I can't reach that high." And so she left like the nail and the hammer and the birdhouse by the base of this tree. She walks in and very briefly, like literally long enough to open the storage cupboard, pick up the stepladder and come back to the tree, which is like literally a matter of a minute, if not less. And the birdhouse was hung.
Huh.
And yeah, and it was the coolest thing. I mean, we were all so excited. We were really, really happy about this and whatnot. But it was just this really lovely moment of connection and cooperation and whatnot. And right. Just enough That's magic in there that you couldn't explain it. And to me, it was just, it was such a great moment. And I love these types of stories because they bring that magic right back. Like it just, it fills me with that magic again. And it's so cool. So to hear about this in juxtaposition with such a violent case that was featured in the movie.
Mm-hmm. The true story behind The Exorcist is horrifying.
Terrible. Yeah.
It's I did make some content about that story a couple of years ago, and I had to take a break. I had to take a break a little bit. So it's just, you're right. It's a bit, it's a juxtaposition. That's, I don't even want to say it's ironic. You're right. It's a juxtaposition between like this house was used for as far as I know, the exterior shots for The Exorcist. You know, so it kind of garnered this spooky reputation just from the association with the movie. But then it's like, you have this really lovely, you know, Victorian author who liked to talk to you while you're eating ice cream.
it's so cool. I know the interior shots for The Exorcist were done on a soundstage.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, by the way, one of the weirder things that happened on the set. They took it was like a year or more to build the inside of this house. And I recently listened to Linda Blair talking about what happened with this. And it was so strange because they took about a year to build this soundstage. And of course, with all the rigs for the bed and all the things that move and, you know, the bed shaking and all this stuff. And William Friedkin, in the middle of the night one night, gets a phone call from one of his set guys. And is like, "You have to get down here right now. This thing has burned to the ground." And he comes running back to set. This thing was cooked, like beginning to end. It was a pile of ashes. And there was no explanation as to why this damn thing caught fire. It was just, it was done. And then they had to spend another like 6 to 8 months rebuilding it again. So it was, so that was one of the weird things, but it was thankfully not this house.
Yeah.
There's so many weird things about that movie in particular. Its association with a serial killer or a suspected serial killer.
Yes. Yes.
Paul Bateson.
So
yeah.
Creepy.
Yeah, that one is freaky.
I mean, he's in the scene where Reagan is, I believe, getting x-rays or spinal tap. I can't remember which exactly.
It was like an MRI or something, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
that scene.
He went on to be accused of and convicted of one murder and was also suspected of murdering at least six other gay men in the New York area, and then dismembering them and dumping them into the Hudson River. You know, and it was actually his case that William Friedkin learned about afterward that inspired him to go ahead and make the movie Cruising with Al Pacino. So it's like this whole story around this film is so bizarre, and there's so much weird coinkydinks, you know, like this, what you've dug up. The fact that there was an actual ghost that lived on that site at one point, or that that haunted that site. I shouldn't say they lived, but you know what I mean.
I mean, both.
Both. Sure. Sure.
Yeah, it's so fascinating that, like, the whole story. And for those who are listening that don't know the original story of the Exorcist, it was actually based on the exorcism in 1949 of a 14-year-old boy that was nicknamed Roland Doe for a really long time, but his actual name was Ronald Hunkler, and he ended up to be a NASA engineer of all things. And he started off basically with this idea that he was talking to an aunt that he was really close to that he called Aunt Tilly. And she was a spiritualist, but his family was super duper religious. And when she passed away, he believed that he was still talking to Aunt Tilly, but it eventually turned out that they believed that no, this was some kind of horrible entity. And then when the doctors evaluated him at Georgetown University, they said, well, no, nothing was wrong, it's all psychiatric and whatnot. And then lo and behold, all of this crazy stuff starts happening around him. Things start moving and flying and whatnot. And J.B. Ryan, Joseph Banks Ryan from the Ryan Institute in parapsychology, was one of the people involved in trying to figure out what was going on with him.
Mm-hmm.
So it was so strange. So I did a show in September. I do a live show called Ritual, and this case is in the live show. And there's a great piece of video from a fellow by the name of Thomas Allen who wrote a book on this, and he ended up with the original diaries from Father William Bowdern, who was the exorcist, and Walter Halloran, and he ended up with the original diaries or a copy of them. And wrote about them in this book, and they're absolutely terrifying. Like the stuff that's described in these things, everything from, like, you know, the crazy voices to the languages that, you know, the kid that shouldn't have known, all of the, like, it was crazy. So what's your take on it, Alex?
I have to say, this particular case is the one that has me scratching my head. It's not like with the story of Annalise Michael or Annalise Michelle, depending on, you know, who mm-hmm. you ask. Where it's more than likely that this was it was a sad case of mental illness. But this particular case has always really boggled my mind because, it was very well documented. And the fact that that Ronald was able to stay under the radar until he passed away is also incredible, by the way.
Totally.
Because, I mean, when the book The Exorcist came out, like, he had to have known. Same thing with the movie. Mm-hmm. You know, he had to have known. And he would have been very much an adult by then. Because this was, he was 1949. He was 14. The movie came out in 1973. Oh, yeah, he was an adult. And I know that he reportedly didn't remember it, but... You know, it just makes me wonder, you know, how much was the Hunkler family aware of this? And I mean, it's a well-documented case. I've read Thomas Allen's book. I've also read Troy Taylor's book on the subject. And it's not even a case of mental illness, really, for me. It's like something definitely happened. Not quite sure what, but yeah, I mean, given how well-documented this case was, this is the one that has me scratching my head. And really, we won't ever really know because we weren't there. But also the way that all of the priests met their end was very odd, too. Yes. If I remember correctly, they all had, like, was it heart issues? I'm trying to remember. They all had...
Rings a bell.
Yeah, they all had some very odd, they also had some really, they just exited their life in a very weird way. But yeah, I think it was like one was, I think a lot of it was heart related, if I remember correctly.
Just like in the film. Right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, just like in the film. Yeah, I know in the diaries, they talked about coat hangers flying out of the closet, an entire kitchen table flipped over at one point. He ended up ripping a spring out of the bed and attacked the priest. Like, I mean, it was so crazy violent. And, you know, the fact that there was a medical community involved, I think to me adds to the validity of what was going on, because they were like, we don't know what this is.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, there was medical intervention. I mean, and Georgetown University, you know, and their medical center, they don't skip steps. I mean,
right. Yeah.
Yeah, they don't skip steps.
The exorcism, or half of it, actually took place at the Alexian Brothers Hospital in St. Yep. Louis. And so, I mean, here you've now got two medical facilities that are going, we don't know what's going on, and by the way, we need an exorcist. Like, that's pretty significant.
Yep. Yep. I think there's definitely something to it. I know in some of the retellings, there is some inconsistencies, like some sources have him in Cottage City, Maryland. But then there's another one that he was in Mount Rainier, Maryland, which, I mean, I'll be honest, they're not terribly far apart from each other. I think I want to say Cottage City is only maybe, yeah, they're like 5 or so minutes away. So really, it's just a debate of like county lines and state lines and that sort of thing. That's not a huge inconsistency there. But his age was a bit up in the air, but at the same time, you know, it's probably trying to protect his identity. So I get it. But the exorcists, well, the big exorcism that we know of, you know, takes place, you know, it happened in St. Louis. But yeah, it was just kind of bizarre that all this stuff happened all in Maryland and Georgetown. I mean, that area is weird anyway, so.
Well, and, you know, it makes me wonder, too, if, you know, all of these different places where they kind of reported him to be at, maybe it could have been a situation, you know, like in the film where she was taking, you know, her child to multiple places saying, you know, mm-hmm. can you help him? So maybe he was at these other spots as well. And they just said, we don't know what this is.
Well, yeah, this, quite possible.
This has been absolutely phenomenal and fascinating and so interesting. And I know for a fact there are, I think everybody here has learned something new, except for mm-hmm. Alex, because you knew the whole story. Yeah. But, you know, I think these little secrets about these places are mm-hmm. they're so enduring, Mike, right?
I'm so glad that we're learning new things. Like, I just love that you had the wherewithal to go digging, and what you came up with was so great. So thanks for sharing that with us.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it just really just came from an area of curiosity. And I love history. I love history. And I already had known about the Francis Scott Key House. So I think a part of it was also, what other historic treasure did they tear down?
Totally. Yeah. Well, where can people talk about your book? Where can they pick it up and talk about the spooky stuff? Because I highly encourage everybody, go read Alex's blog. It's really good. There's so much seriously amazing information in there. So Alex, tell them where they can go.
Yeah. So you can check out my blog at alexmatsuo.com. You can also go to thespookystuff.com. It all goes to the same place. And my latest book is Women of the Paranormal. In that book, I feature 38 women of paranormal history who made significant contributions to the field, and we often don't know their names. So this book is boosting visibility of these amazing women. And I have other books as well about haunted places, personal experiences, and all that good stuff. I'm on TikTok, Instagram, Facebook. Technically, I'm still on Twitter, X. I'm not
whatever
using it a lot
is.
Now.
Yeah, yeah.
Whatever is that dumpster fire is. you know? But yeah, I mean, I'm easily accessible. Feel free to reach out and check out my stuff.
Awesome.
Thank you, Alex.
Thank you.
Hold up.
holy smokes, I learned a bunch of stuff that I had no clue about in this episode.
As always. Yeah. that's what we do here.
Yeah, I am the local dum-dum, I guess.
But it's true, though. I mean, I had no idea about, about this case. And what's so great about it is that it's not what people expect. You know, when we think about The Exorcist, we think about this, you know, violent haunting. And even the case that it was based from was horrific. Like, it was something right out of an actual horror movie. It was so terrible. And then you've got this incredible haunting of Eden with this property, and, you know, her experience when she was, you know, trapped during the war, and these, you know, she heard that voice say, no, you're going to be okay. And just such phenomenal stories, which I think is such a good representation of the majority of this phenomena. But I love it, all of it.
Yeah, me too.
The more we delve into this stuff, the overarching message that we've been getting from day one has been, you know, we're not alone, and the light absolutely dominates the dark in this field, even though it's oftentimes misrepresented. And I feel like Eden's story is such a great example of that, even down to her, you know, one of the last sightings of Eden, where, you know, this Italian grocer, he set up his cart in front of the cottage, and lo and behold, who comes out to talk to him but Eden. And of course, it scares the living bejesus out of him, because he's going all, like, you know, I'm seeing a ghost. But, you know, what a wonderful thing that world is so accessible. And she's just such a brilliant reminder of that.
It's just crazy how we seem to be finding a lot of more positive stories relating to the paranormal. I'm sure you're looking for them, but they seem to be coming to us, which is really fascinating.
Well, yeah, and I think they are the predominant story. Mm-hmm. You know, when you really dig into the real life stuff, this is the predominant story.
I think what people are afraid of is it's the unknown. It's like, 100%. Well, we don't know what happens to us after we die. We don't know, you know, what our consciousness even is. Really?
Yeah.
You know, so what these things tend to scare us when we first have a look at them, but oftentimes they're not quite as scary as they appear to be.
Yeah. And I think you just hit the nail on the head with that, where this, so much of this is perspective. And when you're not accustomed to or expecting, you know, to see somebody who's passed away, I mean, it is shocking. But I think how we frame this in our heads is such a big deal. And throughout all my studies over the years, you know, you can see that this reflected in various different cultures. Like, in my book Teaching the Living, I reference something called the Blue Zones, and the Blue Zones, for everybody who's listening, were designated by a journalist who worked for National Geographic, and they're the happiest places in the world. And what's so interesting about the Blue Zones is that each one has a very different grasp of spirituality. And in many of those places, spirituality and interaction with non-physical, it's very positive. Like, the way they frame it is very, very positive. So the fear isn't the same as it is necessarily in the West, because there's not many Blue Zones in the West. But they frame it differently, and you don't get that high levels of, you know, fear and terror and, oh my God, you know, these things are out to kill me and whatever. And so I think it really is our own work, and like how we reframe it for ourselves, and how we kind of look at this relationship that we all have with non-physical.
Awesome. And thank you for joining us on this eerie expedition, dear listeners.
And remember, the line between the natural and the supernatural is often a thin one. Until next time, stay curious, friends.
Supernatural Circumstances is a co-production of Entity Seeker Paranormal Research and Teachings and Good Egg Studios. This podcast is part of the Curious Cast podcast network. Theme music by Corey Johnson of Catalyst Records in Edmonton, Alberta. You can learn more about Morgan Knudsen at entityseeker.ca and learn more about me, Mike Brown, and listen to my show, Dark Poutine, at darkpoutine.com. Feel free to email the show at supernaturalcircumstances@gmail.com.